This is Clinical Conversations, podcast number 180 from the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. Over the past 15 years or so, community-acquired pneumonia has decreased somewhat in prevalence, according to federal statistics, but it remains, in the words of our guest, a leading infectious cause of hospitalization and death among U.S. adults. Dr. Seema Jain, an epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has just published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine that gives a kind of portrait of community-acquired pneumonia that the Clinical Conversations audience should find useful. Welcome, Dr. Jain.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yours was a 30-month study. Could you give us a kind of an elevator summary of what you and your team were looking for and how the patients qualified for entry?
Sure, absolutely. I think number one, what we were looking for really was to try to fill in the gaps about knowledge, knowledge about pneumonia in adults, to figure out what the actual burden was and also what the potential microbiological causes were, that being respiratory viruses and bacteria. Mm-hmm. We really were aiming to focus on community-acquired pneumonia, and partly because to do a study like this, you have to do a lot of sampling. It appeared best that we should stick to patients who are hospitalized, and there's a lot of questions to be answered in this population. So in order to be enrolled, adults had to be admitted to the hospital, to one of our study hospitals, that is, based on the clinical assessment by treating physicians. They had to live in the study catchment areas because we wanted to be able to calculate population-based incidence, and they had to have signs of acute infection and acute respiratory illness, as well as signs of pneumonia on their chest radiographs.
Okay.
There was also a few exclusion criteria that were focused on excluding those who had been either recently hospitalized or those who had severe immunosuppression.
And the catchment area was generally the Midwest.
We had five hospitals. We had three in Chicago, specifically in Cook County, and then we had two hospitals in the Nashville area as well. So Chicago and Nashville, I would say, are the,
okay,
the two main cities.
Okay. And you note in the introduction that the last survey like yours was conducted in the 1990s, so it was it's time to update those numbers because there are now better diagnostic tools and a conjugate pneumococcal vaccine available.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the reason we thought this was a good time to do this, though I think it probably should be done again soon or in the next X amount of years,
yeah,
is because since the 1980s, we've made great strides in the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine implementation in the United States that has been demonstrated to affect our overall pneumonia rates and specifically due to pneumococcus. So that's one reason. And the second is because in the last few decades, we've also had new diagnostics available, specifically urine antigen tests for pneumococcus, mm-hmm, and also respiratory virus molecular tests that are using PCR methods for a variety of viruses, including influenza, RSV, human metapneumovirus, et cetera. I think the only one caveat is that bacterial diagnostics are still not optimal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the one caveat. But in general, the reason this was a good time is because things have changed since the 1990s.
So let's get back to the portrait of pneumonia. An identifiable pathogen was found in only about a third of the cases, right? These were clinically, these were, as you said, radiologically confirmed and sometimes laboratory confirmed cases. But these are your everyday hospitalized patients with pneumonia. But among those people, only about a third had an identifiable pathogen. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, I think this is your bread and butter for those of us who spend time in hospitals. This is your bread and butter community-acquired pneumonia that that comes in and patients who are hospitalized with pneumonia. This is your community-acquired bread and butter. And yes, in those patients, we only found 38% of those patients had a pathogen that we could discern. I think this is actually, you know, when you look at the literature, it's sort of mid to low range of what other studies have shown. But I think certainly based on clinical experience, so many times this is what happens, is you look and you can't actually find an actual a pathogen. And sometimes it's because we're not looking for everything we should be looking for. And sometimes, you know, we look and we still just cannot find something.
So sometimes there's it's not a pathogen, but it could be an environmental insult or some other factor.
Yeah, it could be a lot of different reasons. It could be because we're not getting the right sample type. It's very hard to get deep samples in patients, both for research and for clinical reasons. It's because we use a lot of antibiotics, which could affect our results. We don't always look for everything. And as you say, sometimes we're too late. You know, there was an insult, but it might have been a week ago, and now our diagnostics are not sensitive enough to pick those up.
Yeah.
So I think it's a complicated issue, but I think it's really, I think probably two take-home messages from that is that it's still important to look as hard as you can and see what you can find.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is that we still have a ways to go with diagnostics for pneumonia so that we can get them to be better and more sensitive and more useful in everyday hospital settings.
Now, among the patients who did have an identifiable pathogen, viruses were, this is among adults now, were twice as common as bacteria. Is that right? So we don't have, a clinician doesn't have the kinds of treatments for viruses that are available for bacteria. So that's...
Yeah, it's a very big issue. Because right now, of the pathogens that we are able to, that many places are able to look for, though cost is always an issue, obviously influenza is the most obvious one, and there are treatments for influenza. But for the other viruses that were very prevalent, including human metapneumovirus, respiratory syncytial virus, otherwise known as RSV, parainfluenza viruses, coronaviruses, adenoviruses, all these viruses, there are no treatments and there are no vaccines. So this is something that really needs to happen, is research and development for treatment and prevention, meaning vaccines, for these other respiratory viruses.
Were there any surprises in your findings?
Well, surprises, you know, I think that we were very surprised early on. So I think you know that we had a pediatric study going on at the same time. And in that pediatric study, we had very good luck with finding pathogens. We have a pathogen detected in 81% of our children in the EPIC study, which was conducted at different hospitals, not the same as the adult hospitals.
Right.
And, you know, I think early on when we started seeing the data come in and we saw that, you know, here we are, we're finding all this stuff in kids and in adults, why aren't we finding it? You know, it was one of those moments where you're like, wait a minute, let's make sure everything is correct.
Yeah.
And it was. So despite the fact that we are consistent with what's out there in the literature, I think certainly I was hoping that with all of the different methods that we use that we would have had higher yield. So I think it's another point that we just need to get better diagnostics.
And now, I wanted to ask you about that earlier study. That was published in the New England Journal in February, I think.
Correct.
And in that study, the viral causes were even more predominant than they were among adults, right?
Absolutely, yes. The viruses were a big portion of what we found. And in the culprit, really, in kids, and I think to most pediatricians would appreciate this, is that RSV was one of the most prominent viruses that we appreciated in children. And, you know, while we do see RSV in adults, too, you know, the more prevalent viruses in the adults was influenza and human metapneumovirus, and RSV was also there as well.
But the earlier survey in children found that the overwhelming majority of them, I think it was, I think it was upwards of 85 to 90%, got antibiotic therapy. Is that right?
Right, in the hospital. So, yes, a large portion of children, I mean, and a large portion of adults are getting antibiotics, certainly patients who are getting hospitalized. And this is not congruent with necessarily what is what we're detecting amongst the patients who are getting hospitalized.
I have a friend who who's a family practitioner who says he offers the rubber chicken cure to parents with sick kids. He says, "Look, I can give an antibiotic, or I can wave a rubber chicken over your kid's head, and it'll have the same effect."
Yeah.
Why do you think, I mean, 90, 85, 90% of kids getting antibiotics, for what are mostly overwhelmingly viral infections, what's happening there?
Yeah, it's an interesting and a great question. As a daughter of a pediatrician who sees adults, but has also three children of her own, I have three little kids. And I think it's really tricky. And I think really, again, I hate keep coming back to the same point, but it's true that it's all about diagnostics. I think to be fair to clinicians, if a child is sick enough to get hospitalized, it's really difficult to discern, is it a virus or a bacteria?
Yeah.
And remember, the tests that we did for the study were done for the study.
Yeah.
Some might have also been done for clinical purposes, but these were done primarily for research purposes. So, you know, it's not easy in every hospital to spend the money on getting a respiratory viral panel. Even if you're able to do that, you can't always rule out that there isn't a bacteria involved because we don't have precise, accurate diagnostic tests to make those differences very clear. So I think that not only do we need to improve the diagnostics we have available for bacteria in particular, but they need to be able to discern between a bacteria and virus, and that is still the greatest challenge I think that we have.
And I guess those tests are on the way, or may be on the way, or I guess clinicians can hope that they'll be on the way, because this is one of the most puzzling things that they confront, isn't it?
It's puzzling and it's frustrating, and I think most clinicians want to curb the amount of antibiotics that are used. We know that there's a huge public health problem of antimicrobial resistance, which is all related to, you know, overuse of antibiotics. So we all want to curb this, but it's hard when you don't have everything you need at hand. There are some biomarkers that are in development, specifically procalcitonin. The EPIC study, that is, are looking at algorithms where we can try to combine procalcitonin with some of the diagnostic test results that we have, including other clinical information, to try to see if we can develop something that could be better able to distinguish. It may be that we can't depend on any one diagnostic test, or we may not be able to determine just based on one clinical feature, but we may need to put multiple things in hand to come up with the ability to differentiate between different causes, microbiological causes, that is, of pneumonia in both kids and adults.
And you mentioned the EPIC study, which is your the name of your team, which stands for the Etiology of Pneumonia in the Community.
That's correct.
Okay, and that's an ongoing.
Yep.
Is it an ongoing study, or is it you've done one in kids, one in adults, and are you sort of on hiatus for the time being?
We've done one in kids. We've done one in adults as well. But I think, so our enrollment is finished, and we're done with that phase of the study. But now what we're doing is many secondary analyses, and we have a lot of novel methods that we've looked at for etiology we hope that we can analyze and get out there and disseminate and make an impact.
Are there other features of this portrait of pneumonia that you want to draw attention to?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things is that I think what we have been able to discuss is the fact that the diagnostics are a big deal. I think one of the things is a good reminder to all of us is that there are some tools that we do have at hand. One of those tools is influenza vaccines, and one of those other tools is pneumococcal vaccines. I think we've done a good job in kids of implementing pneumococcal vaccine. but we have a ways to go with influenza vaccine in kids and adults, and we have more work to do with pneumococcal vaccine in adults in particular. So I think that it is important to note, while we need development for new vaccines, including that for RSV and human metapneumovirus, there are some vaccines that we have at hand that as clinicians we should be talking to our patients about, creating algorithms to make sure that our patients are vaccinated appropriately. So I would think that's a big take-home message from our study as well.
Okay. And you mentioned the pneumococcal vaccine. There was a study in the current Health Affairs, or maybe it was just published online there, but about Prevnar 13, and I think it was conducted by, I'm pretty sure it was conducted by the drug company that makes the vaccine. And they say that, yes, although Prevnar 13, which is now recommended for kids and adults over 50, is more expensive. It's four doses for kids at $100 a dose, roughly. And for adults, it's a single dose. It's going to save somebody or some budget about $12 billion because of the savings in hospitalizations for pneumonia. So that's good news, or the savings are good news for the system, and probably the revenues are good news for the drug company, I'm guessing.
It's a win-win, isn't it?
Well, we're all hoping that it's a
public-private partnership. That's what it sounds like. I mean, I think everybody needs the tools out there. So
yeah.
I think taking into account the cost of the vaccine and the cost of disease averted is a really important piece of evidence to get vaccines that we know are out there into people.
So as we've talked, I think that there are a couple of things that you would say that clinicians should take into their next work week about pneumonia. One is to look carefully for the possible cause of the patient's pneumonia. And the second I thought was, as I heard you, was to be aware or hope for better diagnostic tests to sort out those possible causes. Is that a fair statement of the takeaways, or would you add something else, Dr. Jane?
No, I think those are fair statements. I'd probably add one more, which is vaccinate for the things you can vaccinate for.
Okay, good advice. All right, well, thanks so much, Dr. Jane, for spending time with us today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Joel.
That was podcast number 180. Clinical Conversations is part of the NEJM Group. Its executive producer is Kristen Kelly. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to leave us some feedback on the website, podcasts.jwatch.org, or drop me a note. My email address is jelia@nejm.org. I look forward to hearing from you. See you next time.